Welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. Sitting on my desk, I'm going to tell you what lies ahead. Sitting on my desk are a couple of books. One's ingeniously entitled The Fog of Peace, and it brings back memories of talking to Robert McNamara about his fog of war. It's written, co-authored by Juan-Domenico Pico and Gabriel Rifkind, and Juan-Domenico will be joining me shortly. The other book is a little older, but it's a powerful piece of writing. It has the following title: The Man Without a Gun, One Diplomat's Secret Struggle to Free the Hostages, Fight Terrorism and End a War. And if that sounds a bit over the top, it's entirely justified, because my guest worked for the UN for 20 years, was a negotiator in the Geneva Agreements on the withdrawal of the Soviet troops from Afghanistan, the ceasefire between Iran and Iraq, the freeing of American and UK hostages in Lebanon, and the return of Israeli soldiers missing in action in Lebanon. For this and other reasons, he received the US President's Special Award for Exceptional Service. And he joins us tonight to discuss what we're going to call, with justification, the hostage business. Also with us, you'll meet Susan Dabou, an Italian citizen of Syrian-Italian background, who's written How Would You Like to Die? The Diary of a Kidnapping in Syria. And this describes what happened when she, in fact, became a hostage. So coming up, the hostage business, and then an abrupt and absolute change of gear and tempo. We're going to be discussing the impact of the internet on aspects of sexual intercourse, particularly prostitution and pornography. As matters in the Middle East spiral further out of control, and if you were listening to the news, as I was, we're back into mission creep. Of course, this has been exacerbated by last week's murder of James Foley and the threat of further retribution by IS. But a good story emerged yesterday, the release of another very lucky American journalist, Peter Curtis. Peter's release is particularly interesting because it was negotiated quietly, out of the media spotlight, by American newspaper executive David Bradley and a former unnamed FBI agent who was known for his extensive contacts on the ground. And therein lies the rub. The detailed knowledge of those involved in the murky area of hostage taking and the skills a negotiator has to have to work successfully where lives hang in the balance. So we couldn't get two better credentialed people to discuss matters arising. Gianni is talking to us on Skype, I understand. And we also have Susan Dabou, who's online, and I'm not... Hang on, let me just check. Yes, both of them, I think, are in Connecticut. Okay, let's get started with you, Gianni. First of all, thank you very much for your time. Would you set the scene for us by taking us back to 1990 and that night in Beirut when you got into a car blindfolded?
Well, thank you very much for having me. Let me just tell you that I'm a great believer that every day is different from the day before, and that means that even history moves on, and that what happened and how it was done 20 years ago cannot be done today, because history has moved on. It's not the same. More specifically, during the Cold War, we had very, very few variables, we meaning those who were negotiating at every level between states. The number of variables was very, very few, and therefore it was easier to negotiate during the Cold War. Afterwards, it became more difficult because everybody seemed to be the king of the world, and everybody has its own ways. So that's the difference. In terms of what happened to me, of course, the story of the Western hostages in Lebanon, which included not only British and Americans, as you mentioned, but also Germans, which are not always very mentioned. The case, of course, of the Lebanese situation was a manifestation of a period in history when, of course, it was the first coming of age of the Iranian revolutionary state, namely Iran, and, of course, the connection with Iran and what was happening in Lebanon, where a very significant group also of Shia beliefs was operating, namely Hezbollah, or was just starting, in fact. That was really the basis of the operation. Now, the negotiation for those hostages, which were many, were for a long time, as you know, for many years, some for 7 years. That had three stages. The first stage was that there was a negotiation I had that, directly with the president of Iran, which took a long time to set up. And there was a second stage, which was a negotiation with the very hostage takers. And in order to negotiate for them, I realized this only the very last minute, they wanted to take me hostage. And that's what happened a number of times, not only once. And I was blindfolded and locked up in cars, taken away, and I had no idea where I was. And the third negotiation was a negotiation with Israeli intelligence, which was involved as well, in the sense that one of the requests of the kidnappers was that a number of people taken by Israel also be released. And that negotiation was also conducted by Gertrulli. And so there were three sets of negotiations that lasted a long time in a way, but it was, I had learned by then that you do not negotiate with countries, you negotiate with individuals.
One of those individuals in 1990 held your hand in the car. I find this an extraordinary image. What was its significance?
Well, that was one of the, as I said, I was taken four times. So in one of the occasions, the unexpected situation was that they were in a very bad tension with the Syrian intelligence. So they were doing everything possible to make sure the Syrian intelligence would not get the benefit of any release of hostages in that particular moment. And so he decided, for some reason which I do not know, that when they released me, he would also sit in the car with me. I suppose the purpose was to make sure that I was not being interfered by Syrian security, which, as you know, by the time during the last part of the fighting in Lebanon, was quite active in Beirut. And so he sat down with me, and I do not know what happened in his mind, but yes, he was sitting on the back. I was surprised. It was the first and only time it happened. And he did, you know, basically hold my hand and said, good luck, something of the sort.
This is LNL on RN, and we're discussing the hostage business with Juan Domenico Pico in Connecticut. And before we go to Susan, who's in Jerusalem, I now learn, I want to ask you about the fog of war. Of course, that was about Vietnam, about the things that were not, in fact, clearly discussed or well understood at the time by McNamara or the administration. I suppose it was about the US not understanding the mind of its enemy, and that's central to so much of your work, Gianni, isn't it, to understand your enemy?
Yes, absolutely. And there are two levels there, to be in one word. There is the national narrative, and there is the individual narrative. Anybody who says to you, how do you negotiate with Iran, and says, we can tell you, you know, to negotiate with Iran, you have to do so and so. I know exactly that it's never done in a negotiation. You don't negotiate with countries. I had the fortune, quote unquote, of negotiating with subsequent presidents of Iran. And if I negotiated with one in the same way I did with the other, at least in one case I would have failed. But I was lucky and I succeeded in both cases. So you have to understand that the national narrative, in my view, try to understand, because we never do, and to the extent possible to understand the individual narrative.
Susan, it's time for your narrative now, and I want you to tell us what was happening when you were filming for Italian television, the desecration of a Christian church.
Yeah, I've been kidnapped with a RAI team, the Italian national TV, in a small village close to Latakia, in a small Christian village in Syria. So the problem in our case was that they were not happy of what we were filming. And because we arrived in the village early in the morning and we crossed illegally the border from Syria the day before, so they were not planning to kidnap us. Like other cases of kidnapping, more classical cases of kidnapping, like people kept in Syria, in northern Aleppo, or close to the Turkish border. So in our case, they were surprised by our presence, and they were so upset by the fact that we were an Italian TV, and they told that filming a desecrated church had a political meaning for the Vatican. So they assumed that the local priest called the Vatican. The Vatican called the Rai, and the Rai sent us to film this. And it wasn't the case. I mean, we were there filming the life of the civilians after the first 2 years of war.
It's interesting that there are about 30 of them in the brigade, and you worked out that they'd come from North African countries like Tunisia, Morocco, Libya, Egypt, but there are also Caucasians and Afghans.
Yes, I mean, in my case, it was particularly difficult to look their faces because I was always covered by a blanket used as a burqa because they were extremists. So I was always covered, and also they were covered, but I could see the difference between white jihadis, so they were from East Europe, of course, or Russians, but they were also Africans. And I remember, for example, one jihadi who had a very strong North American accent. So I couldn't see his face, but I understood, I mean, I learned from his accent that he was from Canada or Northern America.
You talk about them as going to war like we go to work. I think that's a fascinating phrase.
Thank you. I was trying to see them as a human beings because I was sure that I was going to be held for a long time, for years maybe, because I heard other cases at that time of other hostages. And also the fact that I was a woman and I was half Syrian, and I did ask to be converted to Islam in order to be respected physically. I mean, this put me in a different situation compared to my Italian colleagues. So I was ready to be with them, and I wanted to understand their society. So I spent 4 days with a woman. She was the wife of one of the jihadists who came from Tunisia. And I tried to understand their mentality, their ideology. She was completely used to violence. She was used to bombardment. So the first night we slept together, I was terrified by the shellings because they were particularly close, and she was absolutely used. I mean, she got used to this, and also the fact that close to the house where we were, the jihadis, the mujahideen, were having their training every day, so they were shouting and screaming, and all this to her was normal, and her husband was used to come at home to have a rest, to have snack, to sometimes also to have sex. So this was their daily life, and I was lucky enough to look at them and to write about it and to survive.
This is Ellie Nell on RN, and we're discussing the hostage business with Gianna Pico and Susan Dabu. Gianni, another thing that strikes a really deep emotional chord in the new book, The Fog of Peace, is you talk about how some of the Hamas in Lebanon still wear the keys to their houses in Jaffa and Haifa from 1948. So there's a narrative, isn't there?
Indeed. Indeed. That's why history is a very personal matter. It is not really the general history that appears for sake of convenience, and of course for the only possibility in books. So yes, there is a story of each of us in different ways, and I think that's why every case is cannot be just repeated, as no life can be repeated. And I think it was evident, of course, that in my history, I spent decades interfering more, I would say is the word, more with the Shia than with the Sunnis. But nevertheless, it was evident that after a few years, what came to my mind was that when you are in minority, you get smarter. And forget not that the Shia have been in minority in the Arab Sea for a long time, at least from the time they lost Baghdad to the Sultan in 1534, date which they still remember in daily conversations. So that it was another aspect because, you know, I'm a minority myself. So that was, in a way, was interesting. Not that I discovered it earlier, I discovered it later. And so there was a kind of communication of a different kind. And it did emerge in my discussion over decades with different situations that when you are in minority, you have to get smarter. And that is why, in a way, this is a generic thing. The terrorists who come from minority groups are usually smarter,
yeah.
Which is not a good thing to say, but that's what it is.
I just admired that phrase of Cezanne's, going to war like we go to work. There's a phrase of yours which I found compelling. You talk about imaging the future. Tell me what that means. Imagining the future. Sorry, Johnny.
Oh, to me. Yes, I think the future has to do with our hopes. And our hopes have to do with the ability we have to build what happens tomorrow. And in a way, minorities had to be, so to speak, smart and more adept to the situation to create a world which was more suitable to them. And so that is... it's something that comes out. The question, the first question that Imam Mughni, I say Imam Mughni, the number two to Hezbollah, mentioned to me the first time he took me. I say his name because according to Israeli intelligence, he was the one who actually got me. He asked me and he said, "Why do you risk your life for somebody who is not a member of your tribe?"
It's a good question. What was your answer?
My question was, the answer was complicated because apart from being, of course, having been taken and having in front of me people not sitting in a diplomatic environment, so to speak, and I was left with just a shirt and underwear after they went through everything. My answer was, I have to answer to him in something which makes sense, but also in something that enters his narrative. And so I said, this is a risk because I do not know. They don't teach you in courses of negotiation at Harvard University how you answer these questions. And so my answer was, I like to pay forward. So I realized immediately that this confused him. And he said, "What the hell are you saying? What do you mean to pay forward?" And I said, "Look, 10 years ago, what was the chance that you and I would meet? Probably 0000 something. So, you know, I have the same thought that perhaps 20 years from now, my son and your son will meet. And your son will have in his hand the chance to save my life's son." And then he exploded in a way, and I said, "My God, this is finished, I'm finished." He said, "Why, how do you know that I have a son?" First mistake I made. And then I said, "Well, I guessed." And then he said, "Okay, but what does it mean to pay forward?" And I said, "You see, if 20 years from now, your son will have a chance to save the life of my son, I like to pay now for that." And then he said, "Where the hell do you come from?"
It's a fair comment. I mean, what you're saying is so extraordinarily poetic in a situation where one would have thought it was, the time for verbal specificity.
Yeah, but it was actually what I'm saying. The negotiation is really between individuals, it's not
absolutely,
really...
Absolutely. Now, it's a very compelling scene. Now, back to you, if I can, Susan. You're imagining the future. You, I guess, couldn't really imagine a future when you were under a blanket.
Actually, I was very concentrated to preserve myself. And physically, first of all, it was important because we have been imprisoned in a very bad, abandoned house. And also, I was trying to preserve myself from, I don't know, kind of very bad thoughts. The first bad thoughts were about the fact that they could harass me, and they could rape me. And this was the first, because I was surrounded by 30 or 40 fighters, and I was the only woman. So this was very scary. And I was not thinking about the future, really. I was thinking about survival. And the future, I mean, I thought that, for example, one night I had the occasion to escape, and I didn't, because I thought that that was not a movie, that was real life. And I mean, to win in that terrible situation in which I was completely submitted, it was to be alive. So I thought that it was better not to escape, to stay with them, even for 5 or 10 years. And if they would release me after 10 years, at that time, I was the winner.
Yeah.
I would won. Because this was my
Is that how you feel now, that you are the winner? Do you feel that?
Yes, I think I'm the winner because I gain a second life, and this is the most important. Somehow they are happy with their decision because I could see them from close, and they are not concerned about anything. I mean, the fact that they have the culture of martyrdom, or the fact that they are not scared about death. I mean, this makes them particularly not concerned about anything. So I'm vulnerable. So they think they are the winner, and somehow they are the winner, but they are the winner in a terrible life. I mean, the life they do is just terrible. I mean, it's life of violence, and even if they choose that violence because they enjoy the violence, but in the same time, I don't think that they have any space for real love.
We're calling this the hostage business, and I want to address that as an issue, Journey, because it is business. It's big business. I learned from you that we're talking about ransoms that run well over $100 million.
Yes. However, I think that the origin of the whole thing it's not necessarily business in that sense. It is really power. And that I first learned is actually I was the first Westerner to enter Kabul after the Soviets in 1979 or 1980. But anyway, it is much to do also with the evolution. The entire Levant, which is the land I walked through from Pakistan to Lebanon in my decades, is really changing dramatically from what it was when we invented it, or rather when it was invented after World War I. And this is what we are witnessing now. We are really witnessing a profound, in a way, civilizational change of a region looking for something, a different structure. And that's what is going on now for the last several years. And that's why at the end of the day, the bottom line is, three years ago, I wrote probably for the first time, and only a British paper published it, we are not speaking about Syrian civil war. We are speaking about a third chess game between Iran and Saudi Arabia in 30 years, and that has become to be proven.
Gianni, you understand this very clearly, but I wonder whether your UN employers understood it. I wonder whether Washington, D.C. ever understood the complexities and the paradox and the almost the Rubik cube complexities.
Well, two things in brief. First of all, the question of war and peace is something that for which the UN was built after World War II, but it was built within a context of the Cold War. When the Cold War ended, the ability of the UN to solve conflicts ended. In fact, since 1992, the UN, or rather multilateralism, has solved nothing in terms of conflicts. And that is because the structure was built on the concept of the Cold War, which was a much easier world, very few variables, as I said. So that in that context, the UN, in conflict resolution only, has been overtaken by history. And what we have now is a different situation. And that's why the UN cannot work in that way. It has always been the conflicts of the last 20 years have only been resolved by bilateralism or minilateralism. And that is what it is. This is just moving forward of history. Nothing else. Nobody's guilty. Just it moves on. We have to understand what happens. You know, there are there are those who still believe and use, when you speak about negotiation, they use the term impartiality. Anybody who tells you impartiality has never done negotiation, because impartiality does not exist. Does not exist. If you put a glass in the middle of the table, you are on one side or the other, I will always see the glass closer to you and vice versa. Anybody who wants to be impartial is not a conflict resolution person or a negotiator who can solve the problem, because he doesn't get it.
Yeah. There is one player in all of this who does seem to be, or claims to be, sort of impartial, and that's Qatar, the go-to place for negotiations these days, I'm told.
No. Qatar doesn't want to be impartial. Qatar is engaged in a, for the last several years, in a kind of a duel, so to speak, with their neighbors, the Saudi royal house. And that's what it is. It's not really impartial. Nobody wants to be impartial, because nobody can be, especially within the frame of mind of the reality in the Gulf. No, but Qatar is very influential because they know how to use the instruments they have, which is money, and also I think a very good understanding of a number of countries in the West.
I brought them into the discussion because they apparently played a significant role in the behind the scenes negotiations for the release of Peter Curtis.
Indeed, and they are doing even more. And you will see more results brought about by Qatar. But that's not exactly, but that is nothing to do with impartiality. It has to do with the fact that Qatar has been playing a very small country, but very rich, has been playing a very interesting role from the time of the Libyan affairs to what is going on now in the Syrian-Iraqi space, as I call it, instead of calling two different countries, which probably is more correct. And I think they're very useful and very nimble.
I wonder whether private companies are operating in this murky world of hostage negotiation.
My answer would be, it would depend of who is the person involved. It's not much to do with the company per se, but with the individuals involved. I mean, institutions of all nature, private or public, find themselves in a world which is changing. Namely, where the individuals is becoming more stronger than institutions, simply because of technology and the economics of the world today. So it's a moving world, so to speak, where you cannot use the same structure or the same pages you used 15 years ago, or 20 or even 25.
Syria is an example of where things get impossibly complex, and this is back to you, Susan. 130,000 dead, more than 6 million people displaced. What's your own view of what's been going on in Syria pre- and post-war?
So, before the war, the Syrians. Civil society was following the Arab uprising, like the Arab Spring, and it began exactly like in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, with the difference that, the Syrian regime is very different to the other Arab regime. First of all, because it's held by a minority, so it's a religious and ethnic minority. And this means that they fight for survival. I mean, if the Assad regime gave up at that time, they would be completely, I mean, that like an ethnic genocide. So that's why the West stronger. The West was not particularly interested to go in that context. For several reasons. One is not particularly interesting for strategic reason. So Syria was completely abandoned for the first 2 years, and that's why I was very keen to go there and to write about the life of Syrians, because maybe I'm part Syrian. So the fact that now there is a huge interest only because ISIS became the new cancer of the Middle East, I find it a bit I found it a little bit ridiculous. I mean, the Syrian situation is very bad, and now we are talking just about how ISIS is bad. But we have forgotten about the use of unconventional weapons during 4 years of war, and also the chemical weapons. So the situation is very complicated.
Gianni, to you, if I might. You just mentioned in passing multilateralism versus minilateralism. I would have thought that Syria's a classic case, or becoming a case where only minilateralism can be effective.
Indeed, and this is why for the last 3 years what we have, I've been writing this very unhumbly, but what is happening, in fact, as you know, even over the last 6 months, particularly more clearly for those who follow this that particular region, the step that will move the reality in Syria and in Iraq is let's call it an understanding or some kind of getting together in some way between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They are the first line players of the region. Everything else comes second. If they don't really play together in some way, which is, of course, absurd because one is Shia, one is Sunni. But let me tell you, in the last 6 months, the unreported rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran has moved on gently, gently. And that is why, for instance, Maliki eventually went. Maliki was a former prime minister of Iraq, stepped down when a number of conversations between the Saudis and the Iranians took place, between the Shias, so to speak, the Shia mother country and the Sunni mother country. And that was the key why Maliki actually eventually left after many people tried to push him out.
We've got to wind it up. Gianni and Susan, I thank you both for your time. It's a huge topic and one which we shall have to keep revisiting. Juan Domenico Pico has been talking to me via Skype from Connecticut, co-author of The Fog of Peace, as well as author of The Man Without a Gun, The Secret Struggle to Free the Hostages, Fight Terrorism and End a War, detailing his work as a negotiator for the UN. Susan Dabou, who was taken captive last year in Syria, but was freed and has written a book of her experiences called How Would You Like to Die? The Diary of a Kidnapping in Syria. And she was talking via Skype from Jerusalem. And now, a health warning, we're about to talk dirty. And if many of you find this offensive, you might like to switch to a more congenial radio program. This particular one is LNL on RN.